This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbian, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. It's our first post-marathon Queer Voices, and we hope you fulfill your pledges here on KPFT. Tonight on Queer Voices, Ray Hill is going to be talking about something. I'm sure he has something to talk about. Jennifer is going to be talking about the movie Trans America. Carol Wyatt's going to be here to talk about some political stuff that's going on. And Greg is going to be interviewing the Reverend John Price. All that's coming up on Queer Voices, and of course we'll be playing some music and portions of This Way Out. All that's up, but first we go to the BBC News in London for the World News Report.
BBC News, I'm Francis Lyne. The Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, has been explaining his decision to leave the right-wing Likud party and form a new political movement to contest general elections next year. In a television address, Mr. Sharon said staying with Likud would have meant wasting time fighting political battles instead of working for the good of Israel. Simon Wilson reports from Jerusalem.
Ariel Sharon looked confident as he made his nationally televised address. He said he could have stayed and fought opponents within Likud and would probably have won the next election had he done so. But he argued that would have meant political wrangling and time wasting and said he preferred to put what he believed were the interests of the country first. By leaving to form a new centrist party, Mr. Sharon said he would be able to pursue the policies which have seen him pull Israeli soldiers and settlers out of Gaza this year. However, he pointedly did not commit to any future pullout from the Israeli-occupied West Bank, beyond that implicit in the roadmap peace plan.
14 out of 40 Likud members of parliament have said they'll join Ariel Sharon's new political movement, which has been named the National Responsibility Party. Amongst them are four ministers, including the Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. The Likud party said it will act quickly to choose a new leader. Senior Palestinian officials have said they're waiting to see how political developments in Israel might affect the peace process. The American Vice President Dick Cheney's launched a robust defense of the Bush administration's Iraq policy for the second time in less than a week, in the light of mounting criticism in Congress of the handling of the war. Mr. Cheney said that senators and other politicians who accused President Bush of misleading the nation about pre-war intelligence were indulging in shameless and corrupt revisionism. From Washington, Oliver Conway reports.
After last week's stinging attack on war critics, the vice president now says he welcomes disagreement, argument, and debate, while repeating his view that it was dishonest and reprehensible for some U.S. senators to accuse the president of purposely misleading the country over pre-war intelligence. Mr. Cheney said it was perfectly legitimate to question the administration's strategy in Iraq, and he described Democratic Congressman John Murtha, who has called for an immediate withdrawal, as a good man and a patriot. A clear reversal from previous White House accusations that the Vietnam veteran was an extremist endorsing a policy of surrender.
You're listening to the news from the BBC. The United States has said it has the votes required to refer Iran to the United Nations Security Council for possible sanctions over its nuclear program, but that it wants to see if continued diplomatic pressure can persuade Iran to return to negotiations on the issue. Jonathan Beale reports from Washington.
The United States says that it wants Iran to be referred to the UN Security Council over its nuclear program, though that view is clearly not yet shared by all members of the Security Council. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said that at present there are no reasons to submit Iran's nuclear dossier to the UN's top body, though he added that Russia did not rule out referral if there was a real threat of nuclear weapons proliferation.
The authorities in Mexico say they've arrested a man believed to be one of the leaders of the powerful drug smuggling organization known as the Juarez Cartel. Mexico's Attorney General said the suspect, Ricardo Garcia Urquiza, was probably one of the most important drugs traffickers ever arrested in Mexico. From there, Claire Marshall reports.
Ricardo Garcia Urquiza, known as the Doctor, is alleged to have been running one of the most powerful drug cartels in Mexico. A spokesman for the Attorney General's office confirmed to the BBC that he was caught earlier this month along with eight other associates. They were arrested in a large middle-class shopping centre in the south of the city. Garcia Urquiza had evaded capture by posing as an ordinary businessman living a middle-class life. Drug barons have traditionally flaunted their immense wealth. Those, such as the doctor, who try to blend in, are now being called the drug traffickers of the new generation.
The United States military says it's flown its last plane out of an airbase in Uzbekistan, ending a four-year deployment in the country. A Pentagon spokesman said control of the Kashi-Khanabad airbase had been handed back to the Uzbek authorities at a flag-lowering ceremony. The U.S. leased the base in 2001 to support military operations in Afghanistan. A new research comparing the different ways that babies are reared suggests there's chemical evidence to support the view that those deprived of affection when young find later life much harder to cope with. The research by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences says that early bonding between a baby and its parent can have long-term effects on hormone levels that control social behavior. The scientists studied children reared in orphanages compared with those from a normal family background. And that's the latest BBC News.
This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Polinsky, and in the studio with me now is Ray Hill.
Shock.
Yes. So, Ray, tell me your life story. You've got 2 minutes.
Again.
No. You have more time than that. But speaking of life stories, you're going to be receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award.
From the American Civil Liberties Union.
Well, that is fabulous.
And they haven't
thrown... How'd you pull that off?
Well, I don't know. I don't know of any other queer ex-convicts that have been getting those awards lately. I, you know how I think it is. I think I just live... I've been watching this series on PBS about Elizabeth, the Good Queen Bess, the first one. Not the Good Queen Bess, the second one. And she was about my age when she died. And I think they said, well, queens die about now. And so they're all trying to catch up and say, thank you very much for all these wonderful things. We want to do that so we don't feel guilty after you die. So that's why you get these Lifetime Achievement
Awards. Well, actually, there's really some truth in that.
I'm getting older and older.
The database, the community database that the caucus has, went through some demographic scrubbing type of thing, and the person who was doing it noticed that at a certain age group there's a lot less men. Mm-hmm. And a lot less than what the demographics of the country is. And then, of course, the reason for that is because of AIDS, HIV, where mm-hmm. a lot of people just passed during that time. So, you know, we're missing a lot of our elders in the community.
But I did get an email from Troy today, and he's a little bit older than me, and it was good to get that.
Yes.
It gives one heart to think on.
Well, just in case people don't know who you are, as you said, you were one of the founders of this radio station. You're pretty much one of the founders, I can say this, of the GLBT community, which was pretty much known as the G community back in the time.
And I was one of the early people that resisted that. They always called me Mother Inclusion because I'm like an old mother hen. If the egg tries to roll out of the nest, come back here, you belong to me.
Well, and certainly I know from the experience of you how protective you were of Wildenstein, the radio show that preceded Queer Voices, that you were very, because at that time especially the word gay or homosexual was on the mass media, it was pretty much in bad terms.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, when you start recounting what one can do, I announced earlier this year my retirement from active involvement in the GLBT political movement because 40 years is long enough to ride any horse. That's plenty time. I mean, if you haven't accomplished what you set out to accomplish in 40 years, then surrender, Dorothy. You're not gonna make it to Oz. It's just not gonna happen. But actually, with the closure coming in the Lawrence case, which of course was our first goal to make us not criminals.
Absolutely.
And when that case came down just 2 years ago. And what a Pride Week that was. And to have been one of the initial organizers of what we now call Pride Week activity, and having been one of the initial organizers of Houston Gay and Lesbian Transgendered Political Caucus, and having played a role in all of it, having come out of the closet in 1958 when nobody else did that, having... rubbed the cat hair the wrong way as a journalist for the student newspaper at Galena Park High School and later at Stephen F. Austin State Teachers College in Nacogdoches, having pushed those boundaries, having stood up to the police department in their raids of gay bars, having identified them in adult arcades and bookstores, having blocked their way when they were coming into Rita Wanstrom's Roaring Sixties lounge to arrest lesbians simply because they had on fly front pants and accuse them of cross-dressing, having dealt with Police Chief Herman Short and Mayor Louis Welch as an openly gay person. There has been a lifetime of achievement.
Well, being so much younger than you are,
and
not living all that history. Well, actually, I didn't live a lot of that history because I didn't know about all that stuff. But as I read the Stonewall book earlier this year by David Carter, I believe the author was, just really incredible. I mean, you told me all these stories, a lot of the stories, but when you actually sit there and read it in a couple sessions and know what went on in the 60s for gay people and even worse, for transgendered people, that people were just carted down. And this is in New York, let alone what happened in other cities, and still happening in some sense in our cities.
And listeners to Queer's Voices know a large amount of the gay stuff because we talk about that periodically. But what about the restoration of voting rights for former inmates? What about calling officers' names unbecoming of their relationship with their mothers and taking that case all the way to the United States Supreme Court and winning 8-1?
Well, and you know, what about this issue? The fact that people may be put on a list of sex offenders and somebody could be a sex offender for a simple thing like urinating
in
public?
We would be on that list if we had not done something about not only 2106 but Texas sodomy law before that. Whenever I came out, they said, well, being queer is legal in California, but you've got to register. And if you move, you've got to notify the police department that you've moved. And people don't remember those struggles. People don't remember going to California to fight Proposition 6, the Briggs Amendment. But Troy called me and said, "Hun, come out here and help us with the media." And I said, "Yes, ma'am." I went out there, and that's where I was. And this is a wonderful story with that. I walked on the studio. And there was this queen, director, and she had Ethel Merman on the set. And she said, "Now, Miss Merman, let me tell you, hon, we don't have a script for this thing. We just want you to ad-lib and talk about some of the nice gay people you've known in the entertainment industry." And Ethel Merman didn't have a hint. Let me tell you, I don't do S&M. Ethel Merman doesn't do without script. I mean, you write her a script, she can deliver it with dynamite. And so Ethel Merman was lost, and I started to reach over and grab this queen and drag her to the side and said, "No, we'll sit down here and write Miss Merman a script. Let her do it, and it'll work fine." And then Ethel all of a sudden brightened up, and she said, "Oh, I know what I'm saying. I know what I'm saying." So they turned up the lights, and she got real close to the television camera and the microphone. She said, "I used to go to the Triple Crown races every year with J. Edgar Hoover and his lover, Clyde Tolson. They were such a lovely couple." And I said, "Well, we really can't use that, but save that film." Because that was invaluable stuff.
Absolutely.
And,
yes.
And to have been there, I mean to have gone to Philadelphia after Harvey Milk was assassinated with the intent of continuing his work on the first March on Washington for lesbian and gay rights.
And you weren't exactly for that first march, right?
Harvey and I had had a debate, but he won. Nobody loses a debate on the scene, especially not with Ray Hill. She's so bullheaded, the old queen. But Harvey and I had a debate, and he convinced me that we could not accomplish my idea of having a national lesbian and gay Congress until after we had had a march, and that would pull us together, and then we would go from there to organize the Congress with the enthusiasm of the march. And we had that debate in Dallas. It was tape recorded by another gay radio guy, Dave Lamble. And it popped up with a historian recently who's from Northwestern University in Chicago. So that book hadn't come out yet, so you'll get the details of that debate. But I lost, and Harvey won. And so I said, "All right, I'll support the march." And he sent me his speech. So that at Houston Town Meeting 1, I read his call for the March on Washington. And then he went to a conference in Minneapolis where the founders of the HRC killed it. Brian Coyle and Steve Endine killed Harvey's March concept in a conference. And Harvey called me, just brokenhearted. He said, Ray, I mean, I went there. I thought that it was a done deal, and they just shot it out of the saddle. I said, don't worry. After the holidays, we'll have another conference in Houston where I've got a little control. And we'll invite who we want to, and we'll get authorization for the march. And then in November, before the holidays, I turned on the television. There was Dianne Feinstein's voice filling the whole television screen.
Yes, yeah.
And she made that horrible announcement. And so I said, well, I don't know where we go from here. But Joyce Hunter of New York and Steve Ault, best organizer in the movement, called me and said, we're going to have a conference to pick up this march idea. And we went to Philadelphia. They debated march or no march for 3.5 hours. I chaired part of that meeting.
Sounds like a Pacifica meeting.
It was. I mean, a bunch of liberals together. Frank Kameny, great. Don't come to Washington. We will not join you there. You will march alone, all 4 or 5 of you. Washington doesn't want you to have this march. Troy Perry, the churches cannot afford to go to Washington. All of these people, National Gay Task Force, all of these people had contrary ideas. But we went and we debated that for 3 hours, and it carried. By night when close, it was a pretty significant margin. There were a bunch of abstentions, but we carried, and then I wound up being asked to chair Phil Harvey's shoes, which don't ever accept a gig like
that. And anybody who wants to know more about Harvey, of course, there's that great book out, The Mayor of Castro Street, but it's also a documentary that you can get at Netflix if you can't get it anywhere else, as Academy Award-winning documentary. Mm-hmm. Just incredible.
And if you want to know about Houston gay history and lesbian history and transgendered history, Jim Sears. The Lonely Hunters covers the 50s and the 60s, and Rebels, Rhinestone, and Ruby Fruit, what a title, covers the late 70s and the 80s. And look at how much space in the index your mother gets. It's Jim was quite taken with that history, and he recorded it. Well, he's a good historian.
Well, you know, it's interesting. In some ways, we've made a lot of progress. In fact, it was interesting in Sunday's New York Times, in the front page of the Arts and Leisure section, there's a headline there about the fact that probably more than likely a number of the Academy Awards for Best Actor will be for straight people playing gay roles.
I read that article. You put it on the internet.
Yes.
That's why I read it. Yeah.
And it's interesting that, yes, we've made that, and whether you can debate about Will and Grace, but we're all over the media in some respects about the culture and stuff. But then yet, you know, the gay marriage thing, which just scares people, and a lot of us aren't necessarily totally behind that
gay
idea.
Gay marriage doesn't scare people. The thing about it is that these occasions to have these referendums, they're not about the issues that are involved. They're about the opportunity for a bunch of Bible-thumping, queer-hating rednecks to say ugly things about us. And they just, you know, they're supposed to be such good Christians, and they just lay in the cut for opportunity to say scandalous things about queers. And so they all come out of the woodwork, and they crow. And then they go back to doing, you know, beating their children and their wives and whatever.
Getting divorces.
Getting divorces and whatever it was. We saved marriage this time. I want you to introduce my new girlfriend and all of that crap. And, you know, if it weren't for hypocrisy, I don't even think we'd have a country. I mean, the vein of hypocrisy runs like silver through the mother lode in California.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, you know, absolutely.
And, you know, I came from that background. I started my career at the age of 13 as a Baptist evangelist. I memorized Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the Gospels, and I was a circuit preacher. I traveled to East Texas and saved souls for $5 a piece and shrunk hemorrhoids without surgery. It was a good line of work. You make good money in that business. But I got to looking at what I was doing, and I gave that up. I took up more honest work. I became a burglar, and I went to prison for that. And I decided that's not a career opportunity, and so I got out and just became a professional queer.
Well, you ran as the station for a while.
Yes.
And wasn't that actually a...
Well, actually, I was corrected the other day by Steve, our chief engineer. He said, I said, I'm the only ex-manager they allow in the building. And he said, except me, and that's true.
That's
Steve
well, right.
Steve was temporary manager right. between all that. And we are the only two managers they'll allow in this building.
Well, wasn't there a concern... by the way, Jean Conquist is in the county.
Yes, she's over at KUHF, yeah.
But the interesting thing is...
His sweetheart. I mean, everybody else didn't like her because she's so bureaucratic. But I'm so glad to see her. Good. I was so sick of this job.
Well, but when you became general manager, there was a concern because you were an ex-con, and was there an FCC rule?
FCC rule was from the old Comstock laws that happened about the same. There was a Senator Comstock, and everything that would come up, he would say, persons that are allowed to do this must be of good moral character. And so the FCC rule said only the managers of broadcast facilities have to be of good moral character. And that didn't have a specific legal definition, but the FCC understood that meant no convicts and no perverts. And I was both. And so the Pacific lawyer said, oh, no, you can't be manager. And I said, look, I'm this old jailhouse lawyer from prison. I said, look, what you do is you notify the FCC that we're not in compliance. And then you sit back and see what they do. So we notified the FCC that KPFT in Houston was not in compliance with rule number so-and-so, and we got a letter back. And they said, oh, well, we're going to put it on the next meeting agenda for the commission. So the lawyer said, now we got to prepare a preparation. There's going to be all this money and all that. I said, no, we don't. That's an invitation, not an order. We don't have to go. Why would we go over there and give them something to argue with? They what's on their agenda. Let them discuss it any way they want to, and then they'll let us know. Meanwhile, I continue to be manager. Okay, and so then they had the FCC meeting. And, of course, they never decide anything at one meeting.
Right.
So we got a letter back and said, the FCC has decided to suspend KPFT from having to comply with rules such and such and such and such. And we've opened up a public discussion period, and it will be discussed at the next FCC meeting, which was like a quarter away or something like that. And then we were notified that the rule lawyers had advised them that there's no legal definition for persons of good moral character. So they
well, that's interesting.
So I became the first queer ex-convict to be a manager of Broadbeard.
But that also brings back the early history of Pacifica, the fact that a nonprofit organization was an owner of a radio license, which back then they didn't really, you know, in the 60s
they didn't
tried
have
to
a concept.
Stop that. Right,
yeah,
right.
We're the people that invented the concept. And so what you now know of non-commercial radio, that's the one over at the university and the other one over at the other university and the other one over at the other university. And the one that's run by the Christians and all of that field was planned by Pacifica Radio. And good Lord, just imagine what we would do without the richness of non-commercial radio and television.
Absolutely. It's saving radio and television.
Absolutely.
In fact, the last time I was in New York, you see all these white headphones coming out of people, meaning they're all listening to iPods. They're not listening to radio anymore.
And that's technology. As a matter of fact, what I'm doing tonight is they're having a board meeting over at... Houston Media Source, and a very stubborn mayor has decided that he's going to institute a policy of prior to broadcast judgment and censorship of First Amendment protected material. And I read those laws. I mean, I've used those laws in courtrooms all over this country. Thank one of the great blessings of my life is that I am not a lawyer, but I hire lawyers, and we have fought those cases in defense of obscenity and in defense of topless dancers and in defense of all of that. So I know the Miller case backwards and forwards, and I think I dated Miller one time, but At any rate, the mayor is damned and determined to operate that facility outside compliance with the law. And to do that, he's going to have to fire the manager who says, no, no, I can't do this because the law does not allow me to do this. And so I went to city council and I spoke and all that. So when I get through here, I'm going to go over there and do an access cable television show talking about trying to save freedom of speech over there. But you can't have a theory, and that is there's not but one picket line. I don't care whether it's transgender cross-dressing related issues, where they used to throw sisters in jail and brothers in jail for wearing the clothing of an opposite gender. Thank you, Phyllis Fry, for handling that struggle. But I was right there holding her hand and went through the process. I sat with Phyllis when she tried her first jury case. And they used to try to close down adult video stores and bookstores and censor gay and lesbian material all over the place. And I was in those struggles. There's not but one picket line. And it is your job, maybe your obligation, to catch in. Find you a place that you're comfortable with the people around you. I don't ask you to work people you don't like, you can't get along with. But find you some people that are, and set about changing things that ain't right.
Creating change. Social justice.
Guess what? Queers do more of that than anybody else on this planet. South Africa is a free nation because of a transgendered woman, white, who stood with black people in South Africa to fight against apartheid.
So Ray Hill, the event that's happening next Friday, a week from Friday, is the ACLU Houston annual dinner. Is it a dinner?
No, it's going to be at First Unitarian Church. They're bringing down Al Franken as the speaker. It's an expensive event. You need to call Houston chapter of Texas ACLU. Their office is over on West Gray, and I didn't bring the telephone number, but it's listed.
Yes, and you can do a Google search for ACLU Houston.
Right. Just Google search for ACLU Houston, and they're not even going to let me speak at that event.
Well,
because they're afraid that I'm going to say something that is embarrassing to the ACLU, and I probably would. I mean, these people are not stupid.
Well, they don't want you to out-talk Al Franken either.
Yeah, Al wants some. He might demand equal time, you know, that sort of thing. So there it will be another event earlier. Ray Hill is going to have a gathering of his friends, which is. We'll have a bowl for donations if people want to make them, but it is a no-charge event, and it's going to be at Treebeards down on Old Market Square.
Downtown Houston.
Yeah, that's in the 300 block of Travis, right across from Old Market Square.
Right. And the website is aclu-houston.org.
And so I want to encourage you to go hear Al. He's got wonderful. The last time he was in town, the Houston trial lawyers gave me the First Amendment Award for the prison show on KPFD, which I gleefully accepted. So every time Al comes into town, I get an award, so I'm going to encourage him to come back more frequently.
Like you need more awards.
Yeah,
right. We're talking
about these love as the founder of Omega House said, thank you very much for these lovely pieces of paper.
Thank you, Ray. Ray Hill, one of the founders of KPFT here in Houston, founder of one of the founders of the Houston Gay Political Caucus at the time, now the Houston GLBT Political Caucus, and of course, Pride. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Protesting Presbyterians put church and state on notice. A new bio book gets inside Hollywood's Center Square. And a new film documents the gay 70s sexual revolution. All that and more this week now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending November 19th, 2005. A renegade New York church and a Virginia pastor with the courage of his convictions took stands this week destined to make waves in the Presbyterian Church USA. Disregarding the denomination's 1997 edict excluding non-celibate gays and lesbians from the ministry, the Hudson River Presbytery approved Raymond Bagnolo for ordination. During his November 13th ordination ceremony at the South Presbyterian Church in Dobbs Ferry, Bagnolo affirmed his acceptance of the authority of Scripture, belief in one God and Creator, and intention to proclaim the Word and Sacrament. However, when asked about his allegiance to the church's constitution, Bagnolo made it a point to exclude the Presbyterians' fidelity in marriage, chastity, and singleness standard, saying that the requirement questions God's creation and contributes to anti-lesbi-gay violence. The Hudson River Presbytery is one of a handful to openly defy the 1997 fidelity-chastity rule, which will be debated again at the denomination's biennial General Assembly next year. But until then, Bagnolo's ordination is clearly illegal, and a complaint could be filed against his presbytery. Meanwhile, Bagnolo has been assigned to pastor the 139-member Palisades Presbyterian Church in Palisades, New York, where the local church board has already declared their intention to ignore the constitutional ban on lesbian and gay clergy. This is a happy and wonderful indication of what can happen when you don't give up, Bagnolo said, and when you wait and see what God has in store for you.
In Arlington, Virginia, the target of Clarendon Presbyterian Church pastor David Ensign's protest is not the church, but the state. Upon accepting a county human rights award on behalf of his congregation, Ensign announced their decision to stop performing traditional marriages because of the state's laws against same-gender marriages. What we're saying is that in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the laws that govern marriage are unjust and unequal, Ensign told the Washington Post. The pastor has already renounced the authority granted to him by the state to officiate at weddings. Henceforth, heterosexual couples will be offered a celebration of commitment at Ensign's church, and then must be legally married by a justice of the peace. While not a violation of Presbyterian Church USA rules, Ensign's action is expected to come up at the denominational assembly next year.
Antagonisms within the worldwide Anglican Communion over LGBT issues have reached a point where cracks are beginning to appear, even on the conservative side of the argument. A letter to Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, published by a network of Global South churches, called for the nominal head of the Communion to take a harder stand against the ordination of non-celibate gays and lesbians and the blessing of same-gender couples. It's purported to be endorsed by 17 of the church's 38 archbishops, but since the headlines broke, several primates have said they did not give permission for their names to be used. First among the dissenters was Bishop of Jerusalem and the Middle East, Clive Hanford. Hanford expressed his reservations about attending the meeting of mostly African and Asian bishops organized by Archbishop of Nigeria, Peter Akinola, but said he felt it was appropriate because it was taking place in his own province. He said in a press release that he left before the fate of the draft letter had been decided and found it most regrettable and in no way helpful to the church's mission that it was placed on a website while Williams was involved in the Church of England's General Synod and unable to respond. At the London meeting, Williams was calling on synod leaders and members to engage in some interactive pluralism. He challenged each individual to make contact with someone in another part of the world who they were likely to disagree with in an effort to ease the suspicion and hostility or lack of mutual respect among Anglicans. In response to the news of the Global South letter, Williams' office said, "If it is an attempt to foreclose the debate, it would seem to serve very little purpose indeed."
Two more young men have been added to the list of gays executed in Iran, and that list may be growing faster than the international community realizes. The International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC, announced this week that it is investigating reports that 92 executions and death sentences have been handed down in just the last 4.5 months. An exiled LGBT rights group has claimed that over 4,000 have been executed by the Iranian government since 1979. IGLHRC and the Muslim LGBT organization Al-Fatiha are lobbying the UN and international human rights groups to take action.
There was both good news and bad news this week for Kansas juvenile sex offender Matthew Lamone. The state Supreme Court last month struck down the so-called Romeo and Juliet sentencing law that punished underage homosexual activity much more harshly than similar sexual misbehavior by heterosexuals. Lamone was serving a 17-year prison term for having consensual oral sex just after his 18th birthday with a boy who was less than 4 years younger. Under the same law, the maximum jail sentence for heterosexuals was 15 months. Lamone was released from prison in early November by a county judge following the Kansas Supreme Court ruling, but he was ordered to stay on his aunt and uncle's family farm, keep away from minors, stay sober, and receive counseling. State Attorney General Phil Klein announced this week that, after careful review and consideration, his office has decided not to appeal the Kansas High Court's decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, which had been an option. But later in the week, County Attorney David Miller filed a charge of unlawful voluntary sexual relations against Lamone, telling reporters that he's not seeking more jail time, but that he wants Lamone to be on formal parole for up to 5 years with the state's Department of Corrections. That couldn't happen unless it was recharged and went through the judicial process, he said. So Matthew Lamone's days in court apparently aren't over. Paul Cates of the American Civil Liberties Union, which represents Lamone, said what Miller is doing is wrong. It seems like the prosecutor is trying to extend the supervision, Cates said. This is for somebody who's served 4.5 years in prison for a consensual sex act.
There was alarming HIV/AIDS news in the U.S. this week about men who have sex with men. According to new statistics released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, gay and bisexual men, particularly men of color, continue to represent the country's largest number of new HIV diagnoses. Slightly more than half of those diagnosed between 2001 and 2004 were African Americans, more than 8 times higher than whites. Latinos accounted for 18% of all HIV diagnoses, more than 3 times higher than whites. Gay and bisexual men of all races continue to account for the largest number of diagnoses from 2001 to 2004, 44% of all HIV diagnoses, and 61% among diagnosed men. New York was, for the first time, among 33 states surveyed in the report, providing a more balanced view of the epidemic across the U.S. The data also reflect an 8% jump in diagnoses between 2003 and 2004 among all men who have sex with men, regardless of ethnicity. But CDC officials could only speculate as to why. According to Dr. Ronald Valdeseri, acting director of the CDC's National Center for HIV, STD, and TB Prevention, riskier sexual behaviors, such as the use of crystal meth leading to multiple partners, may account for those higher numbers. But he said it may also reflect an increase in HIV testing among gay and bisexual men. HIV continues to exact a tremendous toll on men who have sex with men of all races, said Valdeseri, especially men who have sex with men of color. And, said the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force's Matt Foreman, the Bush administration's defunding, deprioritizing, and de-gaying HIV prevention programs has been nothing short of a disaster. We call upon Congress to act immediately to begin to address this tragedy.
And finally, in happier numerical news, figures released this week by Statistics Netherlands show that the number of same-gender couples there has increased in the past decade from about 39,000 to 53,000, and that Amsterdam is their most favored place to live. About 12% of the couples are legally married, and another 10% are in registered partnerships. Perhaps surprisingly, at least compared with other countries where they've been counted, male couples are a bit more prevalent than female couples. 29,000 cohabiting same-gender couples are gay men, and 24,000 are lesbian. About 9% of those couples have one or more children, with lesbian couples more likely to have a child. 18% of cohabiting lesbians are raising children, compared with just 1% of gay male couples. Despite the significant increase over the past 10 years, however, gay and lesbian pairs represent just over 1% of the total number of counted cohabiting couples in the Netherlands. The figures also show that most queer Dutch couples prefer big cities. Nearly 25% live in Amsterdam, The Hague, Utrecht, or Rotterdam. The most popular city was Amsterdam. About 13% of all Dutch gay and lesbian couples live there. But given the city's well-known reputation for a live-and-let-love environment, it didn't require a statistician
to figure that out.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 19th, 2005. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written this week by Lucia Chappell and Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
Turn down the dial. I don't want another. Listening to something I've had enough of. It's all the same, a big misconception. Thinking I'd find what I was looking for. Love is not just a fix anymore. A man needs to feel something more. So maybe it's time that I from the ruin of manic pursuits that left nothing to gain. In desolate bars, drowning in whiskey, in black rooms with boys that don't have a name. At some point we all want the same, to live and let go of the pain. So maybe it's time that I
Levi Kreis, that's spelled K-R-E-I-S. That's a fairly new artist. His brand new album is called One of the Ones, and some of you may have seen him on The Apprentice last week. He was one of the two artists being produced by the two teams competing in front of Donald. Again, Levi Kreis from his album One of the Ones.
This is Queer Voices.
You're listening to Queer Voices. This is Deborah Bell, and here with me in the studio are
Jennifer Renee
and Greg Chapman.
And as Jack said earlier, there seems to be quite a crop of movies coming out in the near future that feature gay characters and are gay, lesbian, transgender, or bisexual performances. Sometimes it's central to the plot of the story and sometimes not. But Jennifer, you've been doing a little research about a movie that I've seen a few clips from, and to me it just looks very promising and really amazing as a film, called Trans America.
Yes, as a matter of fact, Landmark, I contacted them earlier today to get some feedback on when it would be a showing here in Houston, and it's information is it'll debut in L.A. and New York on the 2nd, and then on the 23rd here in Houston at the Greenway and the Angelica, which is nice. We'll have it here locally. What we found out in... One, the story is very intriguing. As a matter of fact, it hit close to home, as a matter of fact, when I was reading the synopsis of it. And again, we're talking about a non-transgendered woman who is playing a transgendered woman.
Actually, she's playing a man who's going through the procedure and is transgendered. And I think in the course of the film does... Or she's living as a woman, right?
Yes.
Or he's living as a woman, but although, of course, uses the pronoun she, identifies as female. But that's kind of interesting that it's a woman playing a man becoming a woman.
Absolutely. Boy, you know, it sounds like Victor Victoria all over again.
Doesn't it? But and it's Felicity Huffman, who most of us know from Desperate Housewives. And
yes.
And I'm not sure in what course she was filming this before Desperate Housewives started, or...
It was before she really hit it big in Desperate Housewives. But they're talking, I say they, you know, the words, mumbles, everything.
The buzz.
The buzz is that there's a possibility of an Academy Award nomination for this film.
At least the ones clips, I've seen. Yeah, the clips that I've seen just are incredible. And she has already won some awards. I can't remember which festival it was, but there's already been some recognition.
Yes, there has been. The beauty of the movie is it's a mainstream production. It's not something, you know, Blair Witch Project type thing. It's the you know, it's a good film. I've seen clips of it. I've read the synopsis for it. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
What is that storyline?
Yeah, what's the gist of the plot?
Well, the story is that Felicity Huffman is playing Bree. The character is named Bree. She's about to have her reassignment surgery when she discovers or is notified that she has a 17-year-old son that she knew nothing about.
She had fathered
a... back when she was sowing some wild oats, had fathered a son who was now 17 and in trouble with the law. And her therapist says that she's not going to give her the go-ahead to have her reassignment surgery until she goes and meets the son.
So you get to meet a son that you didn't even know you had, plus you have this additional layer of being transgender. And, Jennifer, you said you pretty much had the same experience, although I don't think your son was in trouble with the law.
No. It was one of those things where I have a son and who is grown now, and I had apparently fathered a son back in those days.
Unbeknownst to me. One that you did know and one that you didn't know.
Exactly. And who came looking for me.
I'm aware of all the children that I've had.
I guess you would. I didn't contribute nearly as much as you did, I assure you. And it was a very interesting thing. It was a surprise when he found his father wearing a dress. And this is 7 or 8 years ago, which is very interesting. It hit home with me, the storyline, mm-hmm. and the basics, because that's this story is not that unusual. Because of circumstances in our lives, many times we have to leave families. Mm-hmm. And we may leave them and we leave those people we love because at some point we're not able to stay close to them. I know in my own case, you know, my family doesn't have anything to do with me mm-hmm. anymore.
Yeah.
We'll take that back. I have a cousin in New York that likes me.
Uh-huh. Well, one of the things that's interesting about this story is because she does go and meet the son, not as Stanley, not as the father.
No, she meets her son as Bree, and then has to tell him the story of how she was. He's not accepting at all. He's somewhat taken aback, but
she is the only one that can get him out of jail. And she has to deliver him to California, which is the whole run of the story is that trip to California.
Well, it sounds like a really promising film and one that's going to be, you know, we really all want to go see, and we'll get probably some more, be talking about it some more before it actually appears in Houston. You mentioned about the loss of family for people that identify as transgender and certainly queer. I know a lot of people have issues with when they come out, and that's always the biggest fear, losing those that you're care about the most. And this past weekend in the transgender community, or really I should say in all of the community, but there was a day of remembrance for transgender people who had lost their lives due to violence.
Exactly. That was last night at the Holocaust Museum. It began at 6:30, and then the actual event started at 7. It was we closed down at 9. It was wonderful, very moving. It was the largest gathering of people for the Day of Remembrance here in Houston, and part of that was because the GLB community supported it. We filled the auditorium with people from the community, the gays, the lesbians, the bisexuals, the straights. We had a number of people from PFLAG and other organizations, and they were there in support of the transgender community, which is something we haven't seen in the past, which is a real wonderful thing. But story itself, the Day of Remembrance, is in its infancy, only about 7 years, but it has to do with remembering that the transgender community is on the front line of hate crimes, where the easiest to identify. The sad story was told last night, and I think it's worth repeating. There was a young man, this is in New York, was standing on a corner. His girlfriend had dashed into a store, and she had handed him her purse, and he was just standing at the corner with a purse in his hand, and a car drove by and shot him in the head.
Because he had a purse.
Because
should die because you have a purse. That's one reason I don't carry one.
And they should have said it was a man bag, but they didn't care. All they did was he was shot because he appeared to be transgendered.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sad part about it. There's a lot of people out there that just don't understand. It's all about ignorance. Yeah. And
well,
understanding.
It's rooted in homophobia because people still identify transgender as queer and or gay, and they don't understand all the variations of and aren't accepting of any of them either, any gender variants.
Well, I think the sad part is that, you know, all of us simply want to be recognized as human beings. We're all different. There, you know, no two people are alike. Even identical twins aren't alike. And it's just these people, like the people who shot the young man, wanted to steal his humanity. They were saying, in essence, that his life meant nothing. And the people that do hate crimes, the ones that were listed last night that were murdered in the transgender community, are all about taking away our humanity, mm-hmm. who believe in some way we have no worth.
Well, it's that same message that we got in the election, that we're not fully human, we're not deserving of the same rights.
Exactly, and I loved one of the statements somebody made, and I'm going to steal it, and it says, it's not about family values, it's about the value of our families.
Thank you. Say that again.
It's not about family values, it's about the value of our families.
That is so true.
Absolutely.
Once you take away someone's humanity, you can do anything to them, and that's where people start. So, you know, it comes from the churches, it comes from people ranting on TV, and it sort of gives people the license and the permission to start to see people who are GLBT as something less than they are.
Yeah, it comes out of fear.
Yeah.
Fear of other, or sometimes fear of self.
Oh, yeah, and it's worth remembering that the start of the Day of Remembrance is remember back that on, and it's held in November for a reason, because on November 11th, 1933 is when the Nazis gathered the names from the institute in Berlin of the transgendered people, and the day of the long knives that we've heard about, well, that's when they gathered the transgenders and took them to the concentration camps. That's why it's celebrated in November, to remember our dead that were mm-hmm. killed through hate.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully it also be because of remembering that we'll work towards it not happening anymore, or do what we can to reduce the dangers out there. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that Queer Voices is all about, is that we want to make sure that people are fully human and are their authentic selves and can live their lives free of fear and proudly. And so we always work to send those messages out. There are several other films coming up. I think you were telling me that one of them, Brokeback Mountain, that's been getting quite a bit of buzz because it's a award-winning director, Ang Lee, is the director of it. Is,
very much so, and it's going to go to the mainstream theaters. It'll be, I saw it advertised at one of the mainstream, one of the AMC studios, and so I'm looking forward to seeing that. It's interesting that the mainstream theaters and theater chains are addressing and allowing some of these really cutting-edge movies to be shown.
They're not so much allowing it, but as they are that it has become recognized and it is part of our culture of our society and being more accepted. There's Brokeback Mountain is the story of two men that love each other, and there's many layers to the story. So when there's already been, David Letterman's been calling it the gay cowboy movie, so that's kind of the buzz around it has been about the gay cowboys. But you know, two good looking guys, I'm sure that a lot of gay men are going to love this movie. But the stories of their lives and what they go through, and when people see that, they see how it may not be so different than anyone else's lives.
It's real. That's the important part. It's about two people who care about each other, who love each other, and they just so happen to be both male. That's yeah. what it's about. They're good looking too.
It just happens, and it'll be interesting to see if this New York Times story proves true, that because people are playing gay, be they straight or not, the roles being ones that might win awards, not because they're gay, but because the caliber of the acting, and, you know, I think people's idea of what is gay may be changed a little bit. Mm. So that's our wrap up about Trans America and other films that may be coming up. We'll have more on that in future editions of Queer Voices.
If you're here and you're queer, say Q-Q-E-E. Are you Q-Q-E-E? Are you Q-Q-E-E?
This is DJ MCBT, and you're listening to Queer Nation.
Everybody across this nation.
That's FM 69 on your dial.
If you're a queer, this is a station.
We've got some stories from the West Coast. It seems in Portland, because of the same-sex marriage hullabaloo, all of the state's queers are going on strike.
Every queer across this nation is going on strike. It's the new sensation.
We just took you on a quick little trip around the world. How'd it feel, baby?
This is DJ MCBT, and you're listening to Queer Nation.
Everybody across this nation. If you're a queer, this is a station.
That's right. If you're queer, this is the station. We'd like to thank Fontana for playing the theme to Queer Nation this evening. And if you stick around right after this next break, we're going to play their new song, I'm Not Gay.
But my boyfriend is.
I'm not gay.
I'm not gay.
But my boyfriend is.
I'm not gay.
But my boyfriend is.
I'm not gay.
I'm not gay. I'm not gay. I'm not gay in any way. But my boyfriend is. I'm not gay. I'm not gay. I'm not gay in any way. But my boyfriend is. My boyfriend is.
My boyfriend is. And he's a real Nelly one, too.
That was Von Tanner in about the most politically, lyrically dance song I've heard in a long time, called Queer Nation, from their brand new album, The Beauty and the Beats. We want to thank Deborah Bell, Greg Chapman, and Jennifer Poole for that last interesting segment. They didn't introduce themselves, but we're glad they were here talking. And I want to give a plug for next week's Queer Music Heritage, because I'm going to feature interviews with three very talented transgendered artists, Veronica Klaus, Jessica Xavier, and Georgie Jessup. So stay tuned for that next week, and the week after that, another hour of Queer Music Heritage with transgendered music.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky, Joan Devlin, J.D. Doyle, and Glenn Holt, and Deborah Bell.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy.
And also with Jennifer Poole and Greg Chapman. And once again, thank you to all of you who pledged and gave money during our fund drive. We had someone drop by tonight, Nicholas, and made a pledge, even though it's after the pledge drive, and we appreciate every bit of that. Here on Queer Voices on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston and 89.5 in Galveston. And we have a newbie to the radio. I can't believe Jack hasn't had her on before, but I had to lure her and say, Carol Wyatt, won't you please come and be on Queer Voices and talk to us about the many wonderful things you do in our queer community? And she said, well, and I said, oh, come on, Carol, please, please. And so
I
finally,
I don't think it went quite like that. It's true, Daddy, I'm no virgin anymore.
Carol is very active in the community, and one of the things that she started, I don't know, how long has it been now since she started the Nights at Meteor?
It's probably been 3 or 4 years now.
Okay, so every first and third Wednesday.
Yeah, the first and third Wednesday of every month. We call it our professional women's happy hour. And just a really nice, and I like to think nice-looking group of women gather there. Usually we've got, I don't know, maybe 150 women socializing. I'd love to say it started right after work, but the truth is people dribble in starting around 7:30 or 8, and by about 8 or 8:30, we've reached a good critical mass.
Mm-hmm. And Meteor, of course, is over on Genesee,
mm-hmm.
and right off of there, right off of Fairview there. It's
Deborah's diagramming with her hands.
Yes,
for those of you at home.
For those who can see me on the radio.
And by the way, I just lost 50 pounds, which is not true, but we're on the radio, so I thought I would just say that.
Well, then in that case, no. Well, it's not about how much you weigh. It's how good you look, and you're looking good,
uh-huh.
you know. So And the so that's one thing that you've been involved in. And how did that start? You just said, I need a date, and maybe if I get some women to come to the club.
Sadly, that's close to the truth. A lot of us remember the old happy hours that used to occur at Missouri Street back in the 80s. It was a professional women's event every Wednesday of the week. Apparently, we were better at drinking back then. Mm. We've got all gotten a bit older. And that went by the wayside as the bar changed hands. And there wasn't a nice happy hour kind of event for us for the longest time. So time passes forward, and the calendar pages are flipping, for those of you who can't see that at home. And several friends and I decided that we wanted to try to recreate that, and Meteor had just opened its doors, and it seemed like such a nice venue for us, and the Meteor folks were more than happy to accommodate our needs, which were we wanted a place with plenty of bartenders so that it was easy to get a drink, a nice upscale atmosphere, nice seating areas. They were willing to play music that was suitable for our target audience, which is typically 35 to 50-year-old women. Not a lot of hip-hop interest in that age group, oddly enough. Yeah, who knew? Perhaps we could do a study on that later. But anyway, they've been very accommodating. The happy hours have been very successful.
Mm-hmm. And I know quite a few people who enjoy going and having a drink or two.
Well, there you have it, an unsolicited testimonial.
Yeah, meeting friends or making new friends. So that's a good thing to do. And one of the other things you do, you're such a social butterfly.
I'm still trying to find a date 8 years after I became single. It's a sad story.
We'll talk later. So, but one of the other things that you do that's also a wonderful gift to the community is, like me, you run an email list. Yours is a little fancier than mine, Carol.
Well, we're not competitive.
No. I run a group called the Feminist Online Network, or FemNet, which is on Yahoo Groups, and it's pretty a plain vanilla version of things going on in the community of interest to lesbians and feminists. And Carol does something called social notes, because she is the social butterfly.
Please.
It has sometimes some of the same material, but often very different. And you must put a lot of time into putting that together.
Somebody said, so is this your full-time job now? I said, look around. Do you see any revenue-producing opportunities in this? I don't charge for it, and there's no advertising on it. So, but it's a labor of love, and people, it's amazing how many people are kind enough to take time to just send me a quick note to say thank you after an edition of social notes.
Yeah, I get that too, and it's like, oh, cool.
I know, it's very
cool. Somebody actually reads this.
Yeah. So I do it not only as I started out as an email, and it really evolved from just an email reminder of our happy hours coming up. And I thought, then it sort of was, well, I'm sending out an email anyway, and there's another cool event coming up, so I may as well mention that. And it just sort of evolved from there. And then
now you have like all these fancy graphics and people dancing.
I know,
and
dancing
puppy
women.
Dogs
it's just, it's a sight for the eyes.
It is.
It's a visual extravaganza, as I like to say.
It is.
So, what happened was about a year ago, I started getting a whole lot of spam bounces, and boy, you know, nothing like rejection. So I can go anywhere to get rejected. I don't have to go online. So I decided to start it as a website. So Social Notes is a website now. It's www.socialnoteshouston.com, and I use the email just as a reminder to let people know when Social Notes has been updated. But you can go on Social Notes anytime. So there's a calendar. There's a networking page for people who want to promote their business.
My business is on there,
yes,
and I've gotten some work from it.
Again,
yes,
another unsolicited testimonial. An organizations page, page for pets. You know how us lesbians are. We're all about our pets, so if there are lots of pets that need adopting on that page. And there may be something else, but I can't remember it right now.
People that have jobs to offer.
Oh, jobs, yeah, job search, so... Thank you. Apparently, you've been visiting the site more than I have.
Well, I have to check it out every now and then. Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. And I was telling Carol during the break that someone contacted me and was wondering if maybe what I do on the Feminist Online Network would offer something a little different than the politics that Carol does, because my favorite part of Social Notes is the opening, the greeting that she sends out in her email that she calls her rant. Because one, you hit the nail on the head every time about whatever the current political situation is. And it's funny. It's all get out.
Thank you, ma'am. It's sort of evolved over time as well. But luckily, George Bush and crowd are providing me a wealth
of fodder.
And so usually I have to hit him pretty hard every week. And every now and then I'll get a complaint from someone, as the lady today said.
I wouldn't say it was a lady, but.
I'm Southern.
It's a Southern thing.
Yes, we call everybody a lady. So the lady today was looking for social notes without the political rant.
Yeah, I said,
and Deborah
and
I both said, fat chance.
Yeah. I said, if you're looking for different politics than what Carol talks about, then you're looking totally up the wrong tree. So,
but, you know, if the rant really bothers you and the organizational information is important, feel free to skip over it. It's not like I'm penalizing
you. Yeah, you don't have to agree with it.
Well, I'd like it if you would.
Yeah, that's kind of what I do on the Feminist Online Network. It's like, this is my thing that I do, that I give to, you know, several hundreds of people, and if they get something out of it and they like it, then that's fine. But I'm going to promote what I believe in.
Sure.
So
it's power, isn't it?
So give me some of that rant right now, Carol. I want your rant, baby. No.
An on-the-spot rant?
What's kind of cooking in your brain lately?
Well, I normally focus more on national politics, and specifically Bush and the millions of things that he's doing to destroy our country. But I'm mindful of the recent, can you say ass whipping on radio?
I think so.
Okay, that we got the thought police will come get me. That we got in the recent election on Amendment 2, and you know, I think it's good for our community. I don't know if you've looked around. A lot of the straight people are walking more confidently these days. They have a new spring in their step. I think we're monitoring the divorce rate. It's already plummeting. I think there's a lot of good that's going to come from banning us from being able to pollute marriage, and God knows that was needed. Yeah. Right.
Since there already were laws that said we couldn't get married.
Yeah, and I don't know. The last time I checked, I think they were doing a pretty good job of screwing up marriage on their own without really any help from us, which sort of begs the question, why would we want to join an institution that's so messed up?
Good question.
I wish they'd called me, but they didn't. Seriously, I think it's probably going to...
Let me make a note of that.
Would you
make sure
call
you
Carol
call
next
Carol
time
first?
For God's sake.
Please. It would just make... If you were in charge of everything, Carol.
Well, you know, to quote Lily Tomlin, I'm not bossy. My ideas are just better.
That's right.
I like
there
that
you
a
go.
Lot. Yeah. But seriously, I think we're probably at least one or two generations off from getting that passed, and I just as soon would, it's probably politically incorrect to say, but I would just as soon sort of let it lie fallow instead of continuing to get beaten up over it.
Yeah. I think it's because of those rights that you get when you get married that is the concern, and what we talked about is the real message of that vote, which is us not being fully human.
I have a friend who runs a small business in Texas. A big shout out to Bootsy.
Hey, Bootsy.
And Bootsy says, yes, there are lesbians named Bootsy, although not a lot. Bootsy says that she thinks she shouldn't have to pay her taxes as a small business anymore because the state of Texas is not affording her full and equal rights. Bootsy, I may have just scotched that plan for you now that I've announced it over the airwaves. But
yeah, I mean, it does make you think. I mean, are we not taxpaying citizens? Most of us, at least if those of us that are gainfully employed enough to be that.
Yeah.
If we have a job.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
exactly.
It's an idea. Anyway, yeah. I think the key, to me anyway, is to separate the civil and religious components of marriage, and hopefully we can be more successful with that. But as we saw the statistics after the vote, that a depressingly large percentage of other minority communities, the blacks and Hispanics, were against us on this, which I think is tragic after so many people have fought hard for their civil rights that they couldn't step out of their narrow religious boundaries and fight for ours as well. But they saw it not as a civil rights issue,
right,
but as a religious issue.
Right.
So perhaps just banging them over the head with the Bible might be another choice.
Well, that sounds kind of violent, and we are generally opposed to that, especially on Radio for Peace, KPFT.
Oh, sorry. I see the point.
But, yes, I think...
Mark,
I think,
the time, 14 minutes. I've stuck my foot in.
I think that it is good that there's a dialogue that will continue. Now, you have a name for the president, or, you know, he is technically the president of the United States.
I have several.
But there's one I like a lot. What is the one?
Is it Smirky McChimp?
That's the one.
Yeah. A lot of people like that one. There's also Commander Codpiece, of course, taken from the appearance that he had on the aircraft carrier where his little package appeared to be very stuffed. Or else he was very excited to have landed on the aircraft carrier.
I think
he was. Yeah. Yeah, it was a big opportunity for him.
So before we close off, the website again for people that want to get the rant every time there's an update.
socialnoteshouston.com. Please visit at the bottom of every page on the site. There's a little blue box to allow you to sign up to receive the email reminder as well.
Right.
And I hope you'll come visit and come see us at our happy hours as well.
Over on at Meteor on the first and third Wednesdays. And Carol has been a wonderful hostess in the community for an annual Christmas or holiday event, and it became very popular. She would just invite like 300 of her closest and dearest friends, and they would all show up at her house in her lovely home and have great time. And then several years ago, you started doing it as a fundraiser, and this year the recipient of the fee will be Pride Houston, one of our favorite organizations. And if you do go to the happy hour, you might get an invitation.
Well, actually, we've already had our third happy hour of the month, so we've missed that opportunity.
Critical mass here.
Yeah, but you can look on Social Notes. The information is on the calendar page. It's Friday, December 2nd. Hopefully this isn't going out to, well, I hope for your sake it's going out to millions of people, but I don't really have room at my house for millions of people, so there could be a little issue there.
Well, we're not saying any, you know, you've got to kind of find your way.
I said, Deborah, how many people listen to your program? She said, well, we're confident that it's at least two, but we're not sure how many more than that it is. So, two or three of you, feel free to drop by the house. The elves are busy putting Cheese Whiz on Ritz crackers, even as we speak, to prepare for the party.
All right. Well, Carol Wyatt, thank you for being with us on Queer Voices. I do hope that you'll come again and actually do a rant, because I think that's what people will really enjoy hearing.
Well, I have no social life, so I could pencil you in.
There you have it. So
thank you very much for the
opportunity. There. And you're listening to Queer Voices.
Oh, in The Wizard of Oz, the Tin Man wanted a heart and the Lion wanted courage. What did the Straw Man want?
He wanted the Tin Man to notice him.
He's probably best known as the Central Hollywood Square and for his roles as the father in the musical Bye Bye Birdie and Uncle Arthur on the much-beloved TV series Bewitched. But there was a lot more to Paul Lynde than risque one-liners, as Curtis Crick discovered when he spoke with Steve Wilson and Joe Florensky, the authors of a new biography of the actor and comedian, appropriately entitled Center Square.
Steve, tell me about how you got interested in Paul Lynde and how you came to write this book.
Sure. Well, I had always kind of been aware of him, but I hadn't quite realized who he was. I knew Uncle Arthur from Bewitched and Templeton the Rat from Charlotte's Web and various other, you know, Hollywood Squares, Center Square, of course. And I realized that this guy, Paul Lynde, was this pretty amazing presence, and I got interested in him as a comedian. But when I started to look into his life on a more personal level, I realized that there were a lot of great stories about him that had never really been written about.
Joe?
He's always been someone I've sort of known about, and one day I was at the library and I thought, well, think of someone totally ridiculous that I could like start looking for information about, because I have a degree in pop culture, so I just always like people from TV and movies and stuff like that. And so I thought, well, let's see what I can find out about Paul Lynde, and kind of realized he actually had a far more interesting career than I ever imagined, and that just sort of escalated into a research project and then a website and then offers to be on like A&E Biography and then eventually the book, so just kind of snowballed.
Back in the early movies, Paul, who would you be most likely to see on top of Tony, the Wonder Horse?
Oh, my friend Fletka.
Did everybody know Paul Lynde was gay?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I think a lot of people in Hollywood did, but people in Middle America were a little unfamiliar with gay culture, and I think they wrote him off as a kind of crazy, kooky character actor, you know, kind of like a Liberace effect. They just figured it was all an act.
It's kind of hard to imagine the sex symbol status that Paul Lynde had that you describe in the book.
Yeah, exactly. I think that maybe in the same way that young girls are attracted to guys in boy bands, you know, maybe it was the same thing with him. You know, he was this very clean-cut, well-dressed, stylish man. And, you know, that's kind of like a much more comforting kind of crush to have when you're watching daytime television instead of somebody with smoldering good looks. And Paul was a handsome man, but just not in a very macho kind of threatening way.
Yeah, on my website, I hear from quite a few women who were like teenagers in the 70s who just had no clue that Paul was gay and just thought he was just the dreamiest, which is so bizarre to me. It was far more prevalent than I actually thought, and it is very strange.
The great writer George Bernard Shaw once wrote, "It's such a wonderful thing. What a crime to waste it on children. What is it?
A whipping."
He was always very funny, as you say, on Hollywood Squares, but when I read the book, I was really surprised to learn what an unpleasant guy he could really be.
Right. Well, somebody told us that, I think it was Frank DeCaro, the radio host, he had a good point that, you know, Paul was the kind of guy you'd want to, like, party with, but not really hang out with the next day. And, of course, even partying with him could have been nearly life-threatening, you know. I mean, that's when he really let loose on people.
Yeah, he was very unhappy about his career and sort of his lot in life. I think he expected bigger things out of his career. He really wanted to be a movie star, and that just never happened. So I think that all sort of played into his unhappiness.
One other thing, though, I think, though, you know, so there were all these great stories about him just telling off people when he got drunk. And as we started to look into all that, he definitely was, you know, could be incredibly obnoxious and mean. But I also think that there were a lot of fragile egos in Hollywood. And I think that's part of how that reputation also developed. I mean, you know, he was dishing it out and a lot of people couldn't take it.
Did his drinking come from his inability to be more out?
I think there were a lot of bizarre factors in his life that fed into that. Both his parents died within a month of each other, more or less, and that was just a little bit after they found out his brother had died in the war. So there was all kinds of tragedy in his life and a pretty unhappy childhood. But yeah, I think that having to live in the closet all those years, as everybody else in Hollywood had to, was really tough on him.
If you had your choice, Paul, would you rather be kicked by a mule or by an ostrich?
They both sound pretty good to me.
Joe, how does his being gay affect his status as a star in the 70s?
I see him as someone who, you know, never sort of like hid who he was. I mean, he never came out specifically like they do, you know, nowadays. But back then, he was pretty much Paul Lynde, you know. If you knew what to look for, you knew he was gay, and he never really hid it. You know, he never pretended to be heterosexual or, you know, came up with the sham marriage like Rock Hudson did. So in that way, he was sort of, you know, ahead of his time because he didn't play into all the Hollywood games you'd have to keep a career.
He died at the age of 55. What do you think would have become of him if he hadn't died so young?
Towards the end, he was definitely in a career slump, and he was pretty tired of the whole game, you know, looking for work and all that stuff. And he talked about wanting to open up a restaurant in New York, but I don't think it would have lasted too long. I think he would have ultimately maybe tried to go back to the theater.
I think maybe he would have had one of those, like, cameo comedy careers playing the wacky sort of guest star. He had talked about going back to Broadway. I think he would have been great in some sort of 80s musical.
I think eventually he probably would have had some kind of career upswing again, because throughout the 90s, his voice appears in all kinds of cartoons, like The Simpsons and SpongeBob SquarePants, and I think that he would have become kind of this cherished relic almost, who would have been embraced all over again.
And looking back on it all, do you see him as a gay icon?
I don't see him as a gay icon, as someone to kind of emulate, but I see him as an important historical gay icon, maybe, you know.
That's one of the reasons we wanted to write the book, because we think he's kind of this unacknowledged gay icon, because he was out there every day in Hollywood Squares doing his thing and really bringing gay culture to this mainstream audience. And we think that it helped pave the way for Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and Ellen and Will and Grace, and maybe even to a small degree just helping acceptance of gay culture in general.
Some airlines now give you a thorough frisking before permitting you to board the plane.
Well, that's the only reason I fly.
Well, thanks very much for joining us. The book is called Center Square, The Paul Lynde Story by Steve Wilson and Joe Florensky. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
I'm Curtis Crick.
This way out listener, Dr. Robert Simmons Jr. of Dayton, Ohio, in honor of his mother, Mabel Simmons, has issued a donor matching challenge to supporters of this program. To continue doubling our pleasure, Dr. Simmons has extended the deadline to November 30th, 2005. Please visit our website, thiswayout.org, for holiday gift-giving ideas, a year-end tax break, and to see how your help to keep This Way Out on the air will still mean twice as much to us. We'd be very thankful.
This is Queer Voices.
Hello, I'm Greg Chapman, and I'm here to welcome the Reverend John Price.
Glad to be here with you, Greg.
He has been a chaplain at St. Luke's Hospital, and although he is officially retired from the priesthood, he still fills in at Palmer Memorial Episcopal Church. He has been involved in gay ministry for several decades.
Right. I was I became rector of a church in Austin, and it was a suburban, family-oriented church at the when I went there. But Austin just then began its enormous explosive growth. And very quickly, this church was an inner-city church. And the dynamic that happens when a church becomes an inner-city church instead of a suburban one is that not only do the demographics change, but the culture changes. And in the process, quite a few gays started coming. In Austin at that time, the Gay Crisis Counseling Center was actively sending people around to the various churches to talk to clergy to see how they would be received, so that they could recommend this church or not recommend that church. And as it turned out, we got a good rating from them, and so many gays started coming to our church.
And how did that start out? I mean, did some of the people in the gay community approach you directly, or did they just start showing up in the congregation?
Both. They started showing up, and some of them asked to see me. This was the, what I later learned, was the testing that was going on to see what my response would be. The interesting thing is that congregation, when I went there, was, it didn't deserve the term church. It was a dogfight. From the way the place had been founded, in its 18 years, they'd run off all of my predecessors and put two of them in the state hospital and contributed mightily to the divorces or two or three of them. I didn't know a bit of that when I went there, and learned in my first week and began preaching, love God, love your neighbor as you love yourself. Jesus' summary of the law. And this started coming around. And after about 3 weeks of this, a lady came to me and said, this love business that you keep talking about, is this something new the church is teaching? And she was right. It was in that church. All they'd ever heard was thump, 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 this is the way you will do it. This is my way. And what I didn't get up and say that. I said, love God, love your neighbors, you love yourself. And my source for that, of course, was the Lord. And it really turned the place around. I wound up staying longer than all my predecessors put together. And during those 20 years, the culture of that place changed about three times. Its first culture when I got there was suburban, family-oriented, small, and fighting. And then it began to grow and really became quite an important congregation in the diocese.
What happened among the congregation when people who were in the gay community started showing up?
Well,
this is the early 70s, right?
Yes. I had made the point to them that there were three groups in the congregation that didn't like each other. And I said, well, you know, Jesus didn't say you have to like your neighbor. He says you have to love your neighbor. You don't have to like them. You don't have to prefer their lifestyle for yourself. But the Lord has something to say about how you relate to them. Well, that kind of opened up the place. And so they accepted anybody that came in, recognizing that they were interested in learning about the Lord and worshiping Him and being in a congregation that was open and accepting and understanding and, well, loving.
How were you treated by your... what was the reaction among your fellow priests in the diocese in general? You know, because Texas is a fairly conservative state.
Alas, there were several that didn't like this. And I thought, well, that's their problem. I just went in and did the various things I did. I was not the only thing. The bishop said to me at the time, don't become a one-issue priest. And I said, well, you know me better than that. I had many, many interests and became quite involved in many several areas in the diocese and did well in all of them. I was involved, many Episcopalians will know about Camp Allen out between Hempstead and Navasota. I was on the building committee for that 35 years ago. And because I was very involved in the summer camping program. And so we helped build the place and shape it and the like, and we had some real good successes at that.
You've also written some articles about near-death experiences, and I'm interested in hearing about that because I would imagine you've had both people from the GLBT and also straight people who have had those near-death experiences.
This was a fascinating thing. My current count, because it's been so amazing to me that I've kept count and remember the accounts that have been told me, I have now spoken to 95 people who've died and been resuscitated or who spontaneously came back to life. And it's just really been a very fascinating thing. I've been able to use some of these accounts in ministry, and the more I talk about it with people, the more people will speak up and say, well, I had that experience, which is one reason I'm up to 95 so far. And I was concerned about another issue I have regarding people who have to kill in the line of duty in the country, such as a soldier, and contacted a very fine website, the Near Death Experience Research Foundation, NDERF.org, and asked them a couple of key questions about that. And they got me in touch with someone who turned out to be gay and had three near-death experiences thanks to a bad heart. And he had a travel agency in St. Louis, and four of the men who worked for him were also gay, and they were killed one night by a drunk driver who ran a red light. They killed the drunk driver too. And he told me that in one of those near-death experiences, he when he wound up, woke up on the other side from his heart attack, that there were his four dead gay travel agent friends, former employees, and the drunk who'd killed him, that they'd forgiven him. And so he's one, and there have been several others, but that's probably the most striking one to make the point that no, gays don't go to hell. This was the beautiful experience. I've indeed talked to four people who had the hellish experience, and there's a colossal difference between the two.
So what were they like?
The hellish experience?
Yeah.
Well, one of them said that he was being ripped apart by people that he described as demons after death. And he called out God, and they stopped and started screaming at him, saying, there is no God, there is no God. And he realized he had some kind of power over them through this. So he began thinking of all the religious words he could say. And at one point he said, Jesus, help me. And it was like a meteor came and struck them and scattered the others. And he stood up and Jesus took him back to his hospital bed. I know it sounds strange, but that guy is now a United Church of Christ pastor in Ohio. He had been an atheist. And what the four people had in common was they were all mean, really mean people. Mean, after all, is a four-letter word. And that seems to be what God is most unhappy with. strange, isn't it?
That is interesting. So, for the four people that had those hellish experiences, you said one was an atheist. What were the others?
Yeah, well, one had been a member of my church.
Really?
A Christian. And another had been a member of another denomination, a rather conservative denomination.
We won't name names here.
Nah, we won't name names. But you can let your imagination run. In any event, what these four people all had in common was that they were mean. And three of them got another chance and are still alive. No, the lady died. But when what they all had in common was, after the near-death experience, they turned around. Their personalities became warm, loving, caring, looking for ways to help people. Totally, utterly different from what they had been.
I'm curious, for the people who had sort of positive experiences, near-death right. experiences, were they all religious?
No, not all of them were religious. Religious people, you mean?
Right,
yes,
right.
No, they weren't all religious. Many of them were. Many of them were different denominations, different religions. You can look it up on the web. There are several sites. I think the best one is NDERF.org. Those are the initials for Near Death Experience Research Foundation.
That's really interesting, you know, because part of the message that you get out there is that if you're part of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community, it's an automatic one-way ticket to hell. Doesn't matter what you are as a person.
I seem to recall hearing that. not the experience of the ones that I've talked to who've died and been resuscitated.
Hmm.
Not the experience. Which throws the other statements in the trash.
Through your...
And Jesus did not have anything to say against gays. He didn't say anything about gays at all. What he did say was, don't judge.
And love your neighbor.
Right. I turned that congregation around. I should say the Lord turned that congregation around with his love, because it became very obvious that that was what was going on in that congregation. Great place.
Through your... many years, a lot of which you did gay ministry, where did you get the most resistance? Were there certain types of people or certain situations that seemed to bring up a lot of resistance? Did people leave the congregation, or did you have any of that going on?
We only lost two families. In each instance, it was the wife who got furious and stormed out. And the husband was, just followed along and seemed to be sorry to be leaving. I guess if anybody would like to explore that issue of near-death experiences more and read lots of accounts, they should go to that Near-Death Experience Research Foundation site. It's really well done. And the people there are responsive if anyone has a question. And they, after I'd contacted them and talked to them, they said, we would like very much for you to have a corner on this place. So they have the Ray of John Price's corner on that site. And they later had me contribute some other things. One's on the five components of grief. So there's a good deal there in helping people. That's a very helpful site.
Someone gave me a sort of an interesting thing to think about, in the sense that if you have a lot of animosity towards people who are GLBT, and you go to heaven,
right,
and there are a lot of people up there who are GLPT, does that mean...
It's going to be hell for them.
Yeah, does that mean they're in heaven or hell?
Yeah, that's a good question. If they don't want to be around them, they'll be up there.
Yeah, so...
Or whatever it is.
If there's a message there, it's you need to start loving one another.
Right. I take issue with people who take one line out of Paul's statements and beat people over the head with it, because the total message in Paul's statements in his various letters was, he sums it up in the third chapter of Romans, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And it's because of the grace of Jesus Christ that we are...
But Paul also had some misogynist things to say about women, too, for that matter.
True. The only perfect guy was crucified for it.
There you go. I was going to ask you, based on your experiences with NDEs, not personally, but I mean with the people who've experienced them, how has that affected your life?
Well, it certainly has alleviated any fear of death for me completely, because this is one of the things that is common to all of them, is that they just don't fear death at all. And as a matter of fact, many of them are rather angry that that they had to come back. Some of them seem to have had a choice and came back because they still had children to raise. Now, you know, we all know people who died and leaving children behind, so clearly that doesn't happen every time. You can't. But for some of them, they indeed report this, that they had a choice. It's a fascinating area to discuss and explore. There are thousands of accounts on the Near Death Experience Research Foundation site. I recommend it.
And there is also several books that have been written about it as well.
Yes, I have about a half a dozen myself. And I don't think
I'm sure those are mentioned on the site, right?
Yes, some of them are.
Probably. Yeah, yeah.
Probably the landmark book was Life After Life by Dr. Raymond Moody back in 1975-76. And he published a couple of books since. One was Reflections on Life After Life, in which he talked about, he said a couple of thousand people contacted him after the first book, and some of them reported on things that were not in the first book, such as people who commit suicide, that they don't wake up either in hell or in the beautiful experience, but a third one. Now, we don't know whether they stay there or not, but the ones that came back were told it's not your time.
And I've also heard of experiences of people who have committed suicide who found themselves in sort of a waiting place where they felt like they would be there for a very, very long time.
Right. That's what these. That's what some of those accounts in his second book said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like a limbo?
I guess so.
Or a purgatory?
Well, yeah. Except that they weren't being punished.
Right.
The Roman Catholic concept of purgatory, as I understand it, we don't believe in it in the Episcopal Church, includes some kind of punishment, I think. But that is not borne out by the people that I've talked to who've died and been resuscitated.
I don't know, a queue that never seems to be moving sounds pretty hellish to me.
A queue that never...
Yeah, being moving. In limbo, being just waiting forever for something never to happen. It sounds pretty hellish to me.
Yes, yes, I thought you had a different definition for the word queue.
Yeah.
I know a lot of queues that aren't moving, but that's another one.
I remember reading that book, Life After Life, back in the 70s. There were a series of other books that came on along that, but it seemed like that whole concept sort of faded for a while and has came back with the change of the millennium. Is that what you've seen?
I have noticed that there are fewer books, but then how much about it can you say? There are some good websites, and they keep having accounts added to them.
Well, John, I really appreciate you being on here tonight.
Glad to be
here. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. And thanks to KPFD for this.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
Between the Stonewall riots in 1969 and the first cases of AIDS, there was a dozen-year period of unparalleled gay liberation in major U.S. cities that included a sexual free-for-all among gay men. Sex was everywhere, in bars, bathhouses, parks, and piers. Gay Sex in the 70s, a new documentary that chronicles gay culture in New York City during this period, captures the stories of people who lived it and their fading memories of the sexual side of a sexual revolution. Bearing copious clips, This Way Out's Steve Pride chats with producer-director Joseph Lovett about his film, The 1970s, Sex and the City.
There were the Rambles, of course, in Central Park. 24 hours a day full of people actually having sex behind trees. Constantly.
It's hard now to imagine a world where casual sex was casual. When fear of a lethal sexually transmitted disease was unknown. and when being homosexual was more about endless sex than the right to marry.
I'm Joe Lovett. My film is Gay Sex in the 70s. I want to look at sex before AIDS and the development of sexual attitudes and sexual behavior and looked at where it came from. I mean, before 1969, gay people were separated not only from their own feelings, they were separated from one another and separated from the culture in which they lived. And after Stonewall, people came together. And it was a revolutionary period anyway, with all the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement and the women's movement. Life was changing fast. And individuals were getting together and changing the rules. And gay men and women started to do that as well. Arnie Kantrowitz in the film talks about not knowing another gay person except for one until he was 29 years old. And he and his other friend used to write to one another in code. It's hard to imagine from a 2005 perspective, but that's the way things were. The film is not about gay politics as much as it is as about sexuality. The film is about sex. I wanted to do a film about sex. I wanted to do a frank film discussing gay sexuality. And I think that what we've done is, I think we've demystified it.
New York was a constant cruising opportunity. So lunch in Central Park or in any restaurant, everything was laden with, you know, potentially the opportunity for a date.
The storytellers in the film are for the most part in their 50s and 60s, and Lovett's juxtaposition of photos showing them at their physical and sexual peak has an oddly powerful impact.
We showed the film a number of times to different people of different ages, and one group of younger people said that they felt very uncomfortable seeing older men. They didn't like looking at older men, which is why we brought in the pictures of them as younger men, which seemed to help a great deal. And it's natural for younger people not to be interested in people who are their parents' age. I mean, that's natural. I love being in an audience with younger and older people together because it's fascinating to hear the transgenerational conversations. I had one 37-year-old say to me that he could never imagine sex without fear. He didn't know that you were able to think about sex without fear. And an older man in the same discussion said, "Thank you for doing this film. I had forgotten that we ever had sex without fear."
Literally, I have been walking down Madison Avenue on my way to my office before work, 8:30 in the morning, seeing a man on the street, we go like that, change covers, have sex in his office during lunch. I have turned the corner, Christopher Street smiled at somebody, he said, "You got a minute," and we went upstairs. And everybody I know has those kind of stories from those days.
As a producer for ABC News in the 1970s, Joseph Lovett produced What Do You Say When Your Kid Says He's Gay? It was the first gay-positive news special on broadcast television. After a stint as a producer at 2020, Joe left the network in 1989 to form his own production company.
I've been fortunate to have had a career that allowed me to do a lot of work on AIDS, on ABC in particular, and on PBS. That's been very important to me. But this film, I really wanted to be about sex. And I really wanted to separate AIDS and sex. And I really wanted to look at sex and explore the sexual adventure of going from sexual repression, bringing sexual activity into the light, into the open air, and people starting to know one another through sexuality. I thought it was really, really, really important. And as we were editing, we had some fantastic material from our storytellers are so incredibly eloquent, and our stock footage is so fantastic, and our photographs are so wonderful. They're amazing period pieces. We have photographs of just incredible sexual activity going on all over the streets and nooks and crannies of New York and beaches. It's amazing stuff. That's what I wanted the film to be about. I really wanted it to be an open and frank discussion of sexuality.
This has been a conversation with filmmaker Joseph Lovett. Gay Sex in the 70s is in limited theatrical distribution, rolling out for the next few months in cities throughout the U.S. It will be released on DVD through Wolf Video in spring 2006. For more information on this and other queer films, visit PrideOnScreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Sherry Lund, Christopher Gall, Lucia Chappelle, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Curtis Crick, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Rita Gonzalez and to the late, great David Fratkin. The Village People performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Your help to keep this program on the air will still mean twice as much to us, but only until November 30th, 2005. Please log on to thiswayout.org for all the details. To sign up for our weekly email program information messages and or our monthly This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KEOS, College Station, Texas, Contact FM, Hamilton, New Zealand, WWUH, West Hartford, Connecticut, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Blueberry head, wake up in your bed, make off with the dreams that seem to carry you off too late in the day. Wake up, you kitten, fasten your cape, put on your mittens. Perhaps you've forgotten your whiskers and lost your way. The witches have gone out to breakfast, eating frogs and snakes and bat winking.
The name of that group, the Tuna Helpers, an Austin group. The name of the song was Blueberry Head. The CD is called I'll Have What She's Having. And I'm going to remind you also, again, next week on Queer Music Heritage, which is the second half of the show next week, I have a special interview with three transgendered artists, Veronica Klaus, Jessica Xavier, and Georgia Jessup, and they're all very good and also very different, and they all have a lot to say. And what else we got next week, Jack?
Well, we're hoping to do a topic on World AIDS Day.
That's topical, because when is World AIDS Day?
It is December 1st, and speaking of December 1st, KPFT, along with, I used to call it, used to media source, is going to be doing a simulcast from like noon to 4, I believe it is, of a bunch of different items on World AIDS Day. So,
what day of the week is that?
It is on a Thursday.
Okay.
Boy, you're testing me here, aren't you?
Well, people want to know these things.
It's going to be a pop quiz.
People want to know.
Yeah, because Carol's party is the 2nd.
The 2nd,
and then
Friday.
Yeah, and what do I have to do on the 3rd?
Well, you can come volunteer at Pride because we're doing a big mail-out.
On the December 3rd?
Well, actually, we're also doing it on a Thanksgiving Friday. And I'm sure some people will be either sick of turkey and or their family.
Probably the latter first.
Right. So it's going to be 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Friday and Saturday of this weekend. And the Pride office is at 1415 California downstairs. The upstairs, the bar, will be locked at that time, so you can't go to the bar. So if you're interested in volunteering, you can do so there. We also, you're talking about movies, and I don't know if you talked about Rent.
No.
Oh, no.
One of your favorites.
Yes. Well,
you're
going to
be shot, Deborah.
The cast was on the Ellen Show today.
Oh.
And the best thing about Ellen today, Cyndi Lauper singing acoustically She-Bop, which, if anyone knows anything, that song is about masturbation. And I'm like, I can't believe it. This lesbian has this primetime television program and had Cyndi Lauper on there singing a song about masturbation.
I think Ellen is repeated on one of those cable channels later on.
Oh,
I'll have to try to catch
it.
She's live
that.
In New York this week, and she also had Senator Hillary Clinton on, so it was cool.
So, well, anyway,
so Rent.
Rent opens on Wednesday nationwide, and I know it opens at the Algenica, plus the AMC, and a few other places, and you can look it up on the web to see. The stage show was fabulous. I hope the movie is just as good.
Well,
where would you look on the web?
Just look up, well,
Houston, a search on
you
Red.
Know, actually, the Houston Chronicle has a very good section on movies and where they're playing. Unfortunately, they just changed their website over the weekend, and so parts of it are incredibly slow.
Yahoo does a pretty good job of that, too, though.
Okay.
And the Houston
probably
Press.
All have your
all
favorite
are you
places
the,
to do, to find things.
Movies.com.
Movies.com.
There and locally go. It would be Angelica, what? Right?
Yes,
yes, along with some other theaters.
And does Pride on Film list, do they list what's going on in different cities? We should check
that
out.
I found that website, and it was a really great website. I don't think it actually has where movies are playing and when. And, of course, Capote is another great movie.
Another one that's getting that Oscar buzz already.
Yes,
so there might be something to that article about playing gay.
And as Ray was talking earlier about gay history, imagine in the late 50s, early 60s, being gay and pretty much open about it and going to Kansas.
I just want to say what a treasure we have in Ray Hill, and the ACLU honoring him, lifetime achievement, is very just, and I'm glad to see that happen.
And they'll certainly get an earful of it.
Well, we know that's right, but where would any of us be without him?
Exactly. Well, we do want to thank our guests tonight, which include Ray Hill, and also
the wonderful Carol Wyatt
and Reverend John Price. So all of them joining us tonight to be able to talk about different issues. If you have not fulfilled your pledge yet, please do so. You'll be getting it in the mail, I'm sure, of the instructions how to do it, or you can just log on to KPFT and put your pledge. You can, pledge and actually do it on your credit card. So thanks for listening to Queer Voices this week.
Have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 7 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, and Jack Valensky, with remote correspondents Joan Devlin in Iowa and David Elliott in Washington, D.C. For more information about guests, events, and organizations mentioned in the show, visit queervoices.org. Some of the music you heard is listed or available on J.D. Doyle's website, queermusicheritage.org. Be sure to listen every Saturday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
And best-selling author Al Franken will be the featured speaker at the Houston ACLU's 2005 Gala on Friday, December 2nd at 7 p.m.
Franken revolutionized comedy as a writer for Saturday Night Live. Now he is revolutionizing political commentary with books like Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them.
Franken's new book, The Truth with Jokes, was released just last month.
The evening will take place at the First Unitarian Universalist Church, 5200 Fannin at Southmore, and will include a standing reception, silent auction, and a book signing.
For tickets and directions, visit www.aclu-houston.org. Tickets can be purchased at the door, but please purchase in advance. Again, that web address is aclu-houston.org.
This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston. As the end of the year draws near, remember how much you depended on KPFT. This is a time to take stock of what's important in your life, and KPFT is probably as important to you as ever. Help us with a year-end gift of support by adding to your most recent pledge or become a member for the first time. You may have put that pledge off before. Don't let 2005 go without becoming a member. And what better gift to give than a membership to the radio station that brings the music, news, and information you and your loved ones appreciate? Call our membership department at 713-526-4000, extension 314, or pledge online today at kpft.org. And thanks for making everything you heard this year possible. Again, that's 713-526-4000. 4000 extension 314 or kpft.org. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.